Tonight on PBS News Weekend, a community in shock and mourning. A gunman kills 10 people in the Los Angeles suburb of Monterey Park.
Monterey Park is resilient. And what I know about the people here is that we will get through this together.
Then more fallout for President Biden after an FBI search discovers more classified material at his Wilmington, Delaware home. And on the 50th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, a look at the state of abortion rights after the Supreme Court reversed that decision last year. Good evening, I'm John Yang. The predominantly Asian-American community of Monterey Park, California, east of Los Angeles, awoke to tragedy this Lunar New Year. Saturday night, a gunman massacred at least 10 people in a ballroom dance studio. At least 10 others were taken to hospitals, some in critical condition. It's the deadliest mass shooting in the United States since last May's Uvalde, Texas school massacre. Today, authorities released photos of the man believed to be the gunman. But at this hour, he remains at large and many questions remain unanswered, including a motive.
An all too familiar scene. Victims loaded into ambulances, police tape stretched across darkened streets, and as light dawned, FBI agents working the scene. This is the 33rd mass shooting in the United States this year, a year that's not even a month old.
It's very surprising, shocking to hear that something like this went on in not only a small city, but my city. Like, you never think it would happen to your town or something like that.
Police say a gunman opened fire in the dance studio as Lunar New Year celebrations were wrapping up nearby. And authorities say a second incident at a ballroom in nearby Alhambra may be connected.
We are working diligently with the Alhambra Police Department. We believe that there's an incident that may be related. We're not quite there yet, but it's definitely on our radar.
About two-thirds of Monterey Park's population is of Asian descent, and this time of year is significant for them.
It is horrible that such a thing could occur at a time of celebration for so many in the AAPI community and in the Asian community worldwide. This is a time to be with family, to celebrate, and yet this tore a hole through all of our hearts.
With many questions still unanswered, another community in America mourns.
In Atlanta, what began as a peaceful protest last night, mourning the fatal police shooting of a young activist last week, ended in violence. Masked demonstrators smashed windows, vandalized buildings with anti-police graffiti, and set a police car on fire. Several people were arrested. The environmental activist, a 26-year-old who went by the name Tortuguita, was shot and killed by police on Wednesday. The Georgia Bureau of Investigation says the activist had shot and wounded a state trooper. Armed extremists stormed a regional government office in the Somali capital of Mogadishu today, killing five people. The Al-Qaeda-affiliated terror group Al-Shabaab set off a suicide blast at the outside gates to gain access to the well-protected compound and exchanged fire with police security forces. Somali authorities report the area is now clear. And a moment of resilience on this NFL Sunday, just 3 weeks after suffering cardiac arrest during the last meeting between the two teams, Buffalo Bills safety Damar Hamlin went to today's home playoff game with the Cincinnati Bengals. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the state of abortion rights in America on the 50th anniversary of the landmark decision. And some good news about the ozone layer.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
An FBI search of President Biden's Wilmington, Delaware home turned up yet more classified material. The Friday search was coordinated between the FBI and Mr. Biden's personal attorney. It underscores the seriousness of a special counsel's investigation into Mr. Biden's handling of classified material from his days both as vice president and as senator. White House correspondent Laura Barrón López is here. Laura, this is an FBI search of a sitting president's home. Mm-hmm. How did this come about and what did they find?
So President Biden's personal attorney, Bob Bauer, offered this search to FBI investigators, saying that they've been trying to cooperate as much as possible from the very beginning. And it lasted about, you know, almost 13 hours on Friday, January 20th. And essentially what they found was six items, they said, that included some classification markings. We don't know if that's six documents, if it's more than six documents, but they found that during this search and they took that into their possession.
This has been such a long-running drama, saga, it feels. I think it's worth just to walk through this again, the timeline for the viewers.
Yeah, there have been a lot. This is technically the fifth discovery. And so let's go through this timeline of these classified documents. On November 2nd, 2022, Biden's attorneys found documents at Penn Biden Center and they notified the National Archives. Then on November 9th, 2022, DOJ launches its assessment. On December 20th of 2022, Biden's attorneys again find documents, this time in his Wilmington garage, and they notified the DOJ immediately. January 11th of this year, 2023, Biden's attorneys find a single document in his Wilmington residence. January 12th, 2023, DOJ takes possession of five additional documents, classified documents found at his Wilmington residence, the president's Wilmington residence. Then finally, again, as I just said, January 20th, 2023, the Justice Department officials search the Wilmington residence and take possession of six items with classification markings. So again, we don't know if that's six documents. They also took some personal handwritten notes that President Biden wrote during his time as vice president. And I should note that those six items, they said, also included some material during his time in the Senate.
Does this affect his legal liability in any way?
So I spoke to Mark Zaid, a national security attorney today, and he said that optically this is not good. Politically, this is not good for the president. But legally, the facts haven't really changed. Here's what he said.
I'm not really concerned from a legal standpoint that this enhances any likelihood of Justice Department action. In fact, in many ways, it does the exact opposite. The level of cooperation and voluntarily allowing FBI agents to search a sitting president's residence and come up with additional classified records. Well, that at least minimizes the prosecutorial concerns. It just maximizes, unfortunately, how horrible the optics are.
So I also asked attorney Mark Zaid about these personal handwritten notes that were taken into possession by the DOJ. He said it's very normal for FBI investigators to take anything within the time period that they see that these classified documents existed around, and that's what they do because they want to determine if there's anything else potentially within those handwritten notes that could have some classified material. The other thing he said, though, was that these documents could very well not be classified anymore, that maybe they were classified at the time but not really have classified material in them anymore. And again, he noted that the cases are still very different between President Biden and President Trump, namely because of how the two handled what happened after these classified materials were found, and that former President Trump obstructed, and that's one of the big potential charges that he's facing from his special counsel investigation.
Laura Barrón López, our White House correspondent, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fifty years ago today, the Supreme Court handed down its ruling in the case Roe versus Wade. They gave constitutional protection to the right to seek an abortion. But last year, a very different Supreme Court overturned Roe, erasing the right for women across the United States. Ending a pregnancy is now a crime in at least 13 states and severely restricted in at least 12 more. We asked people across the country about what the changes in the last year have meant to them.
My name is Cassandra Glantz. I live in New York City and I'm a social worker. The anniversary of Roe versus Wade brings up a lot of emotions. It just makes me think about how far we've come and now how we're going backwards.
My name is Carolyn Werner and I'm a nurse in New Hampshire. So in New Hampshire, there is now a 24-week ban, and it is a very Republican-controlled state, and I'm fearful that you give an inch, you take a mile, that more restrictions will be coming.
My name's Serena Sigalito. I live in Drexel Hill, Pennsylvania. You know, I've been going to pro-life marches, local ones, since I was a little kid. So when the ruling came down, it was a sense of joy and gratitude, but also just this sense that, you know, now is when the real work begins, right? Like, this was the thing that had to happen before we could really build a pro-life culture and support women and, you know, make it so that no one ever feels like they have to have an abortion.
So when I was 22, I had an abortion. And I don't think that if I had had the choice to be able to terminate that pregnancy, that I would have been able to live my life the way I am now. I being able to go to school, being able to be financially independent, being able to live in a situation where I can take care of my nieces now. I just worry for them that if something happens and they end up with an unplanned pregnancy, that they won't have the ability to make a choice that could alter their lives.
As a mom, part of what I do is sort of trying to show my kids, I have three daughters, you know, and I want them to know that, like, children are a gift and women are pushed to feel like they can't have kids and a job or go to college or things like this. You know, like, instead of having a society that welcomes kids and says, like, you can be a mother and also have a great life, like, we sort of force women to feel like they have to choose.
The end of Roe means for me just a meaning of great hope. And coming into this new age of there's no longer this constitutional right that was never there from the beginning, and to move this new phase of promoting life on the level of the states.
We just didn't think that something like this could happen. And now that it's happened, I think it's really made us vigilant, and that we, you know, even if we have our rights intact, we need to fight to uphold them.
Now the battle over abortion rights has shifted to state legislatures, state courts, and to the U.S. Congress. Sarah Varney is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Sarah, you spent Friday at the March for Life talking to people. Yesterday, you were at the National Pro-Life Summit talking to people. What did you hear? What did they tell you?
Well, I was really struck by the difference in tone and substance between the leaders who were giving speeches in the big ballrooms and then some of the breakout sessions that were really more for, you know, these student groups that come from Catholic high schools and private Christian academies and other kind of grassroots activists that had come from around the country. One of the interesting things, I think, in some of the breakout sessions was just the similarity in tactics that were still being used. So almost not even in recognition that Roe had been overturned. So, you know, an insistence on sidewalk counseling outside of clinics, on, you know, sharing your story of how I saved a baby. And these were people from states like Texas, Louisiana, where there are bans on abortion entirely. So it was interesting how there really hasn't really been a shift in tactics, at least that I heard, the message that was going out to the sort of soldiers on the ground. I think it's going to be interesting to see how does this movement that has grown all of these pro-life activists sort of shift when really now they have banned abortion in these states.
And we've heard that some of these restrictions in the states are preventing women from getting needed medical care. Women who may not be wanting to end a pregnancy, but are having difficulty in a pregnancy.
I think that's what's been interesting in the over the last couple of months is, you know, what has oftentimes just been a very private medical decision with a woman and her family. You know, often, you know, we tend to think about women who want to end unplanned pregnancies, but there are many women who are pregnant and want to be, but they miscarry or there's a severe fetal deformity. So we're hearing, I think people are being really educated on actually how dangerous and unpredictable pregnancy can be. You know, a woman who is miscarrying, going to a hospital in Louisiana, you can still detect faint cardiac activity, you know, a pregnancy that's maybe 10 or 12 weeks down the road. But, you know, when a pregnancy is in demise, that is just what happens. So she's turned away from that hospital. She goes to another hospital. She's still hemorrhaging, and she's still turned away. So we will get to a certain point where some of these women are going to be denied medical care, and someone will die eventually. And then I think there will have to be a real reckoning in terms of the medical establishment of what do you do in these situations when women really do need medical care.
And not trying to end a pregnancy,
correct,
but it's just running into a problem in their pregnancy. You mentioned medication abortions. Now more than half of all abortions in America are by medication rather than procedure. What is the anti-abortion movement doing about that, going after medication abortions?
Well, this is clearly something that very much concerns them. So they have a sort of multi-pronged strategy. One is that they're going to some of the state's attorneys general to try and figure out, can they target the companies that are actually making medication abortion or those that are actually mailing it? You know, if you are in a state like Texas or Louisiana, it is technically illegal for you to get medication abortion. We know that groups like Aid Access that operate outside of the United States are continuing to send medication abortion pills to women in these states. We know women are sometimes setting up P.O. boxes in other states, like in California or Illinois, and then having things forwarded to them. So there have been these workarounds. There's websites like ineedana.org and plancpills.org, where women are going to them. We know they're going to them from these states where abortion is illegal, and they are still ordering them. There's another interesting thing that I heard yesterday at this pro-life summit that I hadn't heard before, which is sort of this new tactic that they're going to take to try and say that that abortion pills are in your water supply. And so they're going to start this campus tour where they're not going to talk about abortion. They're not going to mention a fetus, anything like that. They're not going to say that they are pro-life or anti-abortion. And they're going to ask people if they want to drink the water. Knowing that, of course, all of us take many medications, or Americans, I should say, take many medications, and those things are, of course, in the wastewater, and there are hint traces of things in the water supply. So you can see sort of the next front to try and say that, you know, there's an environmental impact from these abortion pills. I should say that there's no evidence to suggest that that is true.
What about the other side? What about the abortion rights groups? How are they adjusting to life after Roe?
Well, I think they're very concerned also about the medication abortion. So they are doing everything they can to try and protect that. You know, one of the things that's happening right now is there's a lawsuit in Texas from the anti-abortion groups to try and challenge the FDA approval of one of the drugs that's used in abortion pills, which essentially, you know, stops a pregnancy and then also causes a miscarriage. So the abortion supporters are trying to defend that. You know, we saw that the abortion supporters were very successful when they went directly to the ballot, even in a state like Kansas and Michigan. So there's now a lot of discussion around trying to mount these ballot initiatives in other states that allow them.
Sarah Varney of Kaiser Health News, thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, John.
It's one of the great environmental success stories of our time. Scientists say that a 35-year-old agreement has resulted in the steady and promising recovery of the Earth's ozone layer. Located in the stratosphere, about 10 to 25 miles above the Earth's surface, the ozone layer is a critical protective shield, blocking the sun's harmful ultraviolet radiation. William Brangham has more.
Back in 1987, after scientists discovered a dangerous thinning of the ozone layer, 198 countries signed the Montreal Protocol, which largely phased out the use of substances that damage that protective barrier, like chemicals used in aerosols or refrigeration. Now, 35 years later, a recent assessment by the UN shows it is steadily recovering. In fact, much of the ozone layer is on pace for nearly full recovery by the year 2040. Joining us now is Dr. Paul A. Newman. He's chief scientist for Earth Sciences at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and co-chair of the assessment panel that documented the ozone's recovery. Before we talk about the recovery, can you just remind us why we care about the ozone layer, what benefits it provides to us humans and life down here on Earth?
Sure. Ozone is three atoms of oxygen. And most of it is located many miles above our heads. It screens harmful solar ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation can break the bonds of biologically active molecules. It can lead to things like skin cancer and cataracts. So a healthy ozone layer is necessary for life on Earth.
And so were we seeing some of those impacts as the ozone thinned over the years?
We saw a very, very strong depletion of ozone over Antarctica. Over the rest of the Earth's surface, we saw thinning of a few percent, which is not a terribly big deal because the Montreal Protocol captured the problem with ozone depletion And they acted to curtail the production and consumption of chlorofluorocarbons and other ozone-depleting substances. So the problem over most of the Earth didn't get too bad.
So there has been this steady evidence that it looks like the protocol worked as intended. And now this most recent report that you were a part of is really tremendous news. I wonder, what is the reaction you've been hearing in the scientific community?
I think the scientific community has been pretty aware of the progress of things. But to see it all comprehensively, to know that emissions of ozone-depleting substances are declining, to know that levels of these ozone-depleting substances are going down. We see methane, CO2, N2O, they continue to go up, but ozone-depleting substances are going down. And now we see the increase of ozone in the southern mid-latitudes and the tropics and the northern mid-latitudes. This is good news for the scientific community and for the Earth as a whole.
Well, how rare it is we get to say that in this world today. What kind of tangible impacts? You mentioned some of them, that it might be a reduction in skin cancer. Are there other tangible impacts for a repaired ozone layer for us?
Sure. There, besides the health effects for humans, crop yields, crops are damaged by UV radiation. Materials are actually degraded by UV radiation. Other phytoplankton, for example, are affected by UV radiation. So this is overall a very good story for life at the Earth's surface. We, as you might know, we use UV to sterilize, for example, medical instruments. Getting UV down here at the surface is not a good thing. And to see the ozone recovering is a very nice thing to know about.
Is that all good news in this report, or is there anything in there that is troubling to you?
There's a number of things we continue to worry about. We need to continue to monitor the ozone layer. There are new technologies coming on, for example, new supersonic aircraft. One would hope that they could be designed and flown in an ozone-friendly manner. There's also more rocket launches that are going on. They deposit material into the stratosphere. We're worried about the potential impacts of large numbers of rocket launches, and actually, the satellites, as they re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, what do they do to the ozone layer? So we worry about these things. We also worry about rogue production of ozone-depleting substances. In fact, that happened in the last few years with chlorofluorocarbon 11, but the Chinese government acted to curtail that, and it's come back down to a more normal level. So we worry about it, we monitor it, and hopefully countries continue to abide by the Montreal Protocol.
My understanding is that targeting these particular chemicals was in somewhat easier because there were safer alternatives available for industry. The other big emissions that we're trying to stop, obviously, is carbon and methane, as you were describing, which drive climate change. Targeting those emissions, obviously, is a much steeper climb for humanity, right?
It very much is a steep climb. People have gas stoves, they have automobiles, burning fuels, we have power plants burning coal. These are all CO2, carbon dioxide producers. And solving the problem of carbon emissions will be very difficult. That doesn't mean it can't be done. Every nation on the Earth has signed on to the Montreal Protocol. In all the political differences, national differences, every nation has identified the ozone layer as something that needs to be watched and preserved. And they've all signed on to the Montreal Protocol. So I'm actually optimistic that something will be done eventually about climate, and we will cure this environmental problem.
All right, Dr. Paul Newman at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And before we go, an update on the shooting in Monterey Park. This afternoon, SWAT team south of Los Angeles breached a vehicle of interest. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office later confirmed the standoff around that vehicle is over. And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.